Is it possible for any but the most famous authors to make a living doing what they love? Are there writers who do nothing but write fiction or poetry all day? To help aspiring writers better understand what to expect, Mandela Martin has edited a new collection of essays from Simon & Schuster called Scratch, Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living. Mandela Martin, the founder of Who Pays Writers and Scratch Magazine, joins us now, along with two of her book's contributors, Leslie Jameson, author of the award-winning essay collection Empathy Exams. Her work has appeared in Harper's, Oxford American, among other publications. And also here is Alexander Chi, author of the award-winning novels Edinburgh and The Queen of the Night. He is a contributing editor to The New Republic. I'm very pleased to welcome these distinguished writers to our show now. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Mandela, considering that this is a book that deals with the difficulty that writers often have getting paid for their work, I'm just slightly uneasy asking this question. Did you pay all of the contributors?
I did, and that was very important to me. I did pay contributors. People who wrote new essays for the book got a bit more. People who whose work I reprinted or who had reworked their work.
And you interviewed some.
And some were interviews. Those people did not get paid, as journalistic ethics dictate.
You founded a magazine called Scratch and gave that name to this collection. What does that word mean when it's used in reference to writers earning money?
Well, it's slang for money. You would say, like, oh, got to get some scratch together. And then it also has a sort of scrappiness about it that I think is really suited to what it's like to be a writer, sort of putting together a living out of all the various things we do.
And of course, when writers wrote with pens, they were scratching on the paper.
Yes. Chicken scratch.
Chicken scratch.
Leslie, are writers often asked to work for free?
Yeah, I think all the time. I mean, I certainly have worked for free. I think it's a different calculus each time. My agent would kill me for saying, confessing that publicly.
Well,
that
is there some adequate
free.
Etiquette as to when you say yes and when you turn something down?
Well, for me personally, there are a couple different reasons that I might do a project. And if I'm committed to writing the piece or feel really passionate about writing something, then I'll just write it and figure out afterwards whether I can get paid for it. And sometimes, especially in the past, the best home for a piece might be somewhere where it wasn't getting paid. But I do think, and my experience of being a writer, you know, when you were talking about, oh, is there the writer out there who writes poems all day? You know, every single writer I know, their days are some kind of jigsaw puzzle of the labor that pays the rent and the labor of the heart.
They teach or they work for a publication or edit or do something else.
Absolutely. I mean, in my 20s, my jobs were more service industry based. So I was like a barista. I worked at a bakery. I worked as an innkeeper at a B&B. I worked as a tutor. I think there are also a lot of people who are doing more like teaching, editing, that kind of freelance.
And I remember some writer said when he was asked about being a copywriter that you can't be a prostitute during the day and a virgin at night. But
as a former copywriter, I disagree.
Now, Alexander, you write that in submitting articles, you were paid as much as $3 per word and as little as nothing. Why is there such an asymmetry?
capitalism. I mean, I think that, you know, the like a lot of us, I probably make my living out of, I try to do a mix of things for free and things for as much as possible, as much money for as little work, I suppose, is the calculus there.
Well, does it depend on the venue?
Oh,
would you work for free if you knew you were going to have a bigger audience? Because I would assume it's more likely that you're going to be asked to work for free for a smaller publication.
Oh, no, not at all. You'd be surprised at the big places that would ask you to write for free. I think, you know, I developed a system early on where if someone said that writing for free for them was going to guarantee me a big audience, I would go to Alexa and check their web traffic rankings, and then I would make my decision about whether they actually had the traffic to back up that kind of claim. But I think, you know, the thing with these things that we write is that, you know, yes, on the one hand, we do this work of the heart as Leslie said, but also we only have so much life to give to this work. And the more that we are paid, the more we are able to work. So it's really, for writers, money is time. Mm-hmm. And these, it's like, especially if I'm writing essays about my own experiences in particular, you only get a few takes on that before you don't really have the ability to write about it anymore, probably, not with any credibility. And so you want to make sure that that you don't sell your life for cheap, either in terms of hours spent on the work or the experiences that you're describing.
I'm speaking with Alexander Chi and Leslie Jameson, two of the contributors, along with Jonathan Franzen, Cheryl Strayed, Jennifer Weiner, Roxanne Gay, Yi-Yun Lee, Suzanne Orlean, to a new book that was edited by Manjula Martin, the founder of Scratch Magazine, called Scratch, The Writer's Money and the Art of Making a Living. It is published by, who's publishing this? Oh, Simon Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you write, Alexander, in your essay called Wizard, about how interesting you found the correspondence between Gustave Flaubert and George Sand, especially when they wrote about money. And I invite everybody else to join in on this conversation. Do writers talk a lot about the money aspect of the work?
Well, it's funny. I mean, so I had always been told that this correspondence was like the most brilliant literary correspondence that ever existed. And when I actually turned to it, I found that it was almost entirely about money. How much do you get paid for this? Do you have money for this? How much do you think I could get for this? And so on. And, you know, it was interesting because they had very uneven social class positions, and they were having a friendship across those positions. And Flaubert had a great deal more security than she did, than Sand did. Even though Sand was also just, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, an absolute champion at getting her work finished and paid for. I think, you know, now writers, I hear a lot from people when I talk about money with them. I hear a lot of people say to me, oh, you know, people don't really talk about that. I'm really glad that you talk about that. And I find that a little surprising, and I wonder if it's, I always wonder if I'm breaking some sort of, you know, code that I'm not supposed to be talking about it. But I honestly don't think it's a bad thing to talk about it.
And well,
I think
Leslie, you were nodding your head.
No, I was just going to say, I'm glad you're breaking the code, Alex, because I mean, I wish people talked about money more, because I think it can be incredibly lonely making or alienating to both be wrestling with these issues that every single one of us is wrestling with, but also to feel like it's the kind of shameful part of the profession, that you're thinking about it as much as you are, devoting as much time to it as you are. And I think that there's something, just a liberating authenticity about just getting honest about the fact that it's part of the creative life.
And why is it considered taboo?
I think part of it maybe comes back to that, the having a friendship across social positions dynamic that Alex was alluding to between Flaubert and Sand, that it can be uncomfortable to speak to somebody when they don't know your position, you don't know their position, this idea of inequality. But I actually think that it just deepens whatever the divides of inequality and kind of sustains them to make it something that always has to be kept in the margins of silence.
And Manjula, yeah. In almost all of your interviews, you ask the writers about their social class, whether they've changed it and which class they identify with.
I do, yeah. I think the class component is a huge one in writers. And Susan Orlean in our interview talks really smartly about that, where she talks about how even though she makes a lot more money than perhaps some other writers, like, she considers herself to be like a part of the artistic class. And I think there is a lot of truth to that. But I also think that one of the things we talk about when we talk about money and literature, I would extend this to most of the arts also, is access. Like, if only there's a lot of privilege in the literary world, there are a lot of the chain to sort of having access to the industry involves things like unpaid internships and writing for free, as we've all done and will probably continue to do sometimes, using our own rules for that. And if you're not a person who has the luxury of writing for free or sort of treating discussions about money as though they're déclassé, then you don't have access to this business. And that directly affects the types of stories that are getting told.
Wasn't it assumed for a while that most writers already had some money? Proust didn't have to work for a living. He just could have, you know, he was a gentleman writer. And we have a lot of writers throughout the history of literature who started off rather comfortably.
Yeah. there are a lot of gentlemen writers, and there continue to be. I think in the book there's an essay by Colin Dickey, a nonfiction author, where he goes into the history of the first Greek poet to ask to be paid by the word.
Simonides.
Yeah, and how everyone thought he was really not classy and very greedy for doing so. And I think that is, you know, so there's a longstanding history of sort of this idea that money taints the arts.
Poets are the easiest people to pay by the word, right? Wouldn't poets be the
depends on the poet?
What about you, Alexander? Are you asked to submit works of fiction for no pay?
You know, literary journals are a little. They're well known for not being able to pay you very much. You know, like $50, $100, $200, and maybe like a few contributors' copies, sometimes just contributors' copies. And in those cases, you know, like, the calculus with that is always, like, will this journal then, you know, is this journal helpful in terms of, say, your tenure file if you're also, you know, employed somewhere and possibly going out for tenure? Or will they put your work up for other anthologies like the Pushcart Prize or Best American or whatnot? Like, if you're someone who, for example, can't really afford to work for free, but you are approached by a situation like this, if you can think through some of those aspects to it, then you can take a risk like that a little better than, say, someone else. But I think, you know, nonfiction is the thing that pays the most. Fiction, short stories, especially paid short stories from magazines, that has been in decline at least since the 90s when Tina Brown took over The New Yorker and cut back the number of stories that that The New Yorker published. Yeah. And also sort of promulgated a myth, which was that people didn't read short stories in magazines, which was, like, I know a lot of people who still, like, scream her name in the night over that one.
And Manjali, you also have people talking about finishing a novel, having spent years working on a novel, and now having no money to pay the rent because they haven't been able to do anything else. Or
yeah,
going on a book tour and being expected to pay for a hotel that they can't when their credit cards are maxed out.
Yeah, I put this book tour on my credit card, just in interest of full transparency, which I should say is not necessarily a slight on my publisher. It's very common that publishers don't send authors on book tours nowadays, which is a thing that has changed somewhat. I think it's really a hard thing. It takes a lot of time to do what we do, and figuring out how to, you know, surface that work while also paying the rent is the big question, I think, for most creative people.
Well, I think that's one of the many things that is productive about just bringing these conversations into the open, is that there's nothing that's been more helpful to me in figuring out how to support myself as a writer than just hearing other writers' accounts of how they made it possible, which are infinitely more helpful when they actually get into the nuts and bolts and really affect the kind of work that gets paid. Like Alex was talking about how different genres get paid in different ways, which is absolutely right. I also think about, you know, reading a quote from Gay Talese, like, lamenting how young writers are constantly writing about themselves rather than writing journalism. But the truth is, like, journalism costs a lot more for a young writer who's not on staff at a magazine, isn't getting funded, you know, for pitches. Like, it's actually kind of, in a certain way, it's more economical to write about personal experience than to pay to fly yourself to Europe to report some piece, you know? So those kinds of the shifting economic terms are part of figuring out how, understanding those terms is part of figuring out how to produce the kind of work you want to make.
I have to take a little break here, but we will return to Leslie Jamison, author of the award-winning essay collection, Empathy Exams, She also writes for Harper's, Oxford American, and other publications. Alexander Chi, his award-winning novels are Edinburgh and the Queen of the Night, and he's a contributing editor to the New Republic. And the book that we are discussing was edited by Manjula Martin, who's the founder of Who Pays Writers and Scratch Magazine, and it's called Scratch, Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Stay with us for more. And we're back with a bunch of writers. Manjula Martin, who's edited a new collection of essays from Simon & Schuster called Scratch, Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living, which has some very impressive contributors, two of whom are with us, Leslie Jameson and Alexander Chi. And I think most people assume that one of the ways that you that writers are helped is that they get an advance when, well, first, let's even back up a bit. Can you even get a book published if you don't have an agent?
It's been done. It's it's being done, yes.
But it's rare. A lot of publishers, they give the intern the slush pile, the books, the unsolicited manuscripts that come in, and it's unlikely that any of those books are going to be published.
Yeah, well, there's also a whole world of self-publishing, which I don't know very much about, to be honest.
And I think, I mean, as far as I know, with big New York houses, I think most everything that gets published comes through an agent. But there's also a really active and kind of remarkable world of indie publishers who are putting out some of the work that I'm most excited about. And I think some of those publishers, it would be more likely, I mean, most of their submissions would come through agents, but maybe a little bit more possible to get to them not through an agent.
But you say that in the case of advances, actually, they don't come right away, so they can't really keep you going through the full time that you have to devote to writing a book.
They come in fits and starts. Usually when you get a book advance, it's broken up into several installments, so you'll get some of it, you know, anywhere from a quarter to half of it usually when you sign the contract, and then the other payments are dependent on you delivering the book and it being ready for publication, and then on the day of publication.
Alexander, was that your experience with your novels?
Well, I was going to say, if you have an agent, they can negotiate for you to get paid on completion, like on signing and then on completion, so that you're not waiting for a last check on publication day. So there are some advantages to having an agent. And I think that, you know, the sort of, you know, my first novel sold for $6,000, and my hardcover publisher was an indie publisher that went bankrupt before paying me the last $2,000 of it. My second novel, you know, was a more generous advance, and that advance didn't see me through the writing of the entire book, but it did make a lot of things possible, and I'm very grateful for that.
Cheryl Strayed talks about her advance in the book, where, you know, she viewed it as getting like a pretty good grant once a year for, in her case, it was 3 or 4 years for her first novel.
It's a big difference between fiction and nonfiction, too. Like, my first book was a novel, and with a novel, you really have to fund, at least for me, because I was not a known name at all, I had to fund the entire writing of the novel, because you can't sell a novel unless you're known until it's done. So you have to get it, figure out a way to get it written. Whereas with certain kinds of nonfiction, it's much more possible to sell the book on proposal and have that first part of the advance funding your writing of it.
Manjula, didn't Nick Hornby tell you that the era of writers getting big advances and movie deals are over?
He did tell me that.
He said the door slammed behind him.
You know, that's something that I've definitely heard a lot from writers who have sort of reached a more successful peak in their career. I mean, I think people still get big advances. It happens, it hits the news every now and then. And Alexander talks about this in his essay. You know, it's not a new thing for the publishing world to be all a Twitter about $1 million advance for a first novel. But it's also not a particularly sustainable goal.
It's a thing that happens perennially, I think, that also there's like a series of articles that come out that suggests that suddenly writers are paying $1 million, you know. And if you Google, like, the $1 million novel, like I say in my essay, you can see a forest of these pieces show up going back to at least to the era of Donna Tartt.
But they're really part of the PR aspect of selling books, aren't they? Because it's almost impossible for me to have a first novelist on the show who received a huge advance without me saying, you got a huge advance. That's part of the story. You also say you had three professors who had university housing, good salaries, and time to write. Is that lifestyles disappearing?
That is another, payments to writers have been under attack, and also academia. So as, a kind of restructuring of academia has occurred in the last 30 years, more and more you see adjuncts in departments and more administrators, for some reason, who have access to the funds that faculty used to have. And I'm not really sure. That's not really a sustainable model either. It's the faculty who are working for such low pay are, often driven into poor health. There was just an essay about this man who was selling his blood, who's an assistant professor somewhere.
Josh Roiland at the University of Maine, yeah.
And he was just trying to pay off his debt from being an adjunct.
And Leslie, you teach at Columbia. Do you warn your students about these sorts of things?
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing, and Alex just got to it, I mean, one really important thing to say when you're talking about the Academy funding writers is there's just a huge difference between the way that labor is compensated for tenure track faculty and the way that labor is severely undercompensated for adjunct faculty. And it's a scandal of the Academy. And then another scandal of the Academy, which, I do talk to students about, is student debt and the way that, MFA programs fund in very different ways. But there are a tremendous number of young writers who are in debt for a variety of reasons. And one of them is that some writers who are getting paid to teach in the Academy are getting funded essentially by the student debt of students who are paying to be part of it. So
you also say that there are two focal points, New York and Iowa.
No, that I wouldn't MFA. Be caught saying that, but I was actually trying to kind of push back against this model that insists that there are sort of only two worlds. There's the New York world and the MFA or Academy world, and they're entirely separate. To me, what's interesting about talking about the New York writing world and the writing world of the Academy is actually that it's one way of accessing this question of who's funding writers today. And there is some funding coming from big New York publishing houses, big New York magazines, and there is some funding coming from various academic institutions. But as Manjula said earlier, and I think made a really important point, there's a lot of people left out by those funding equations, and there's still like a pretty rarefied mode of access to the literary world. So,
and I think it's a sort of a false dichotomy. Yeah. Like, there's neither one nor the other. They're parts of the same world.
Susan Orland told you that being a writer is like running your own business. Do you think that writers are prepared for that? Don't they see this as something very different? I'm an artist.
Yeah, I think I personally think that writers are not prepared by that. Are not prepared for that by the programs that they attend. I, even just on this book tour, talking to students at MFA programs and students even in undergrad programs who have no idea of the basic economics of this industry. And I think there's great value in sort of an MFA program where people can take time away from the commercial aspect of their business and really work on their craft. I'm not dissing that necessarily. But I also find it somewhat unconscionable that one can get a terminal degree in one's field without even having the slightest idea of how it functions.
There's a kind of nervous breakdown people have after they get their MFA that I think comes from not being prepared in any way for what they're going to do afterwards in terms of making a living.
Yeah.
Do you encourage your students to supplement their incomes with, say, copywriting for advertising agency?
I try to talk them through a variety of things. Like, there's a lot of great jobs that you can have as a writer that, I had a friend who works... I have a friend who works as an assistant to a researcher who doesn't need her very often, and so she spends a lot of time in the office writing her books and then also has insurance. And then every now and then he asks her to do something, like FedEx a pillow that he needs.
Dream job. Like,
There's, you know, it's. I think the problem is, in some ways, is that there's these narrow ranges of things that people think you can do, but there's so much you can do that doesn't, like, rob you of the will to write also, you know.
I mean, you know, because I teach at a nonfiction writing program in New York City, and all of my students, it's not even a question of supplementing their income, it's a question of creating their income. And part of my, actually, like, privilege as their teacher is I get to read about, like, the widest, wildest variety of jobs, and certainly have worked them as well.
But even successful writers, getting back to Nick Hornby, he says that he relies on speaking fees to supplement his income.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty common, actually, with writers who are fairly prominent. Austin Kleon, the writer of this book called Steal Like an Artist, who's also in Scratch, talks about how he's trying to increase... He wants his income to be primarily from speaking gigs. Because apparently, when at a certain level, those pay. At other levels, they don't pay, as we were talking about during the break.
Well, most politicians, after they get out of politics, they live off of speaking fees. So
yeah. Yeah.
I guess unless you run for president, it's something that can't be used against you. Alexander, you say that one of your professors taught you to use the Best American Essays collections as a guide for submitting works. How is that helpful?
Yes, Annie Dillard suggested that. Sure, her method was basically to look through the collection, figure out which publications were the ones who had essays that were included in the anthology, and then to look in the back at the notable essays and see which magazines had published those, and then, you know, addresses were included in the back, but always to double check because things change, as she said. But it was a very useful sort of strategy for thinking through how to begin sending out work, and it made it less terrifying. You know, when I was leaving her class as an undergraduate, I knew one writer who was a professional writer, and he was a newspaper columnist, and he wasn't writing anything like what I wanted to do. So I didn't, in terms of, like, people who would tell me what to do besides my teachers, there really wasn't anything in my environment that told me what to do. So it was always about, did I have the nerve to ask somebody what I didn't know? Mm-hmm. And that was always the thing that I had to push myself to do.
Leslie, should there be courses in colleges specifically about how to survive as a writer in the real world?
Well, this is one of the things that I was thinking about earlier in the conversation, is I certainly believe that it's a pretty important part, especially of graduate writing education, to give students access to forums where they can ask precisely those kinds of questions that Alex is talking about, asking about all the things they don't know without feeling shamed for asking them, without feeling like they're taking this, like, beautiful aesthetic conversation and polluting it by introducing the question of money into the room. So for me, part of what we try to do at Columbia is facilitate, like, panel discussions where those are explicitly the questions on the table, but also in some of the craft classes, not just talk about, well, how do you put a work of reportage together, but how do you write a pitch? How do you think mm-hmm. about how you might sell this piece? So introducing some of those pragmatic questions into the conversation.
What do you wish somebody had advised you about? I'm running out of time, so you have to make it quick.
I think that what Alex said about not being afraid to ask what you don't know is a pretty beautiful and durable idea.
Did a lot of writers talk to you about this, Manjula?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The number one sort of response that I've had, both from the contributors and the readers to this book, has been, oh my God, I'm so glad that it's not just me who's asking these questions.
There's going to be a panel discussion tonight featuring Manjula Martin and fellow Scratch contributors, including Leslie Jameson. That's at 7 o'clock at Powerhouse Books in Brooklyn at 28 Adams Street. RSVPs are appreciated. You can find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. The book is called Scratch, and my great thanks to Alexander Chi, Leslie Jamieson, and Manjula Martin for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.